I don't always listen to podcasts, but when I do, I listen to STEM Talk, interviewing the most interesting people in the world of science and technology. Stay curious, my friends.
Welcome to STEM Talk.
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 Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Dawn Cornegus, and today we have Dr. Kirk Parsley here with us. Also joining us is Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests to appear on STEM Talk.
Hello, Dawn. Good to be here with you. Today's guest, Kirk Parsley, was another unanimous selection of the Double Secret Selection Committee.
Kirk is a physician, former Navy SEAL, businessman, and as we will hear today, an expert on sleep and its many benefits.
Among those elements of health that we can control, sleep is among the most important, if not the most. In today's world, it is fashionable to exclaim something like, "I'll sleep when I'm dead." Unfortunately, that behavior may lead to that condition. That is, being dead, sooner than the speaker might hope. Folks tend to obsess about all sorts of health-related issues, some important and some not, but often do not concern themselves sufficiently with sleep. Dawn, I understand that you first met Kirk nearly 10 years ago now.
That's kind of scary, actually. But yeah, Kirk and I actually met at an undersea and hyperbaric medical society meeting that was in Maui, Hawaii. So he's been a great colleague ever since. Before we get to today's interview, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we especially appreciate all the wonderful 5-star reviews that are piling up on iTunes. As we announced in several earlier episodes, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing the iTunes reviews with an eye toward selecting the best reviews to read on STEM Talk. There are extra points for pithiness, wit, and of course, lavish praise.
If you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk shirt. Today, our winning 5-star review was posted by someone operating under the moniker CCK197. And as soon as we hear from CCK197, a STEM Talk shirt will be on the way.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, this is going to be...
Okay. I think I can see why this review appealed to the Double Secret Selection Committee.
Here is the winning 5-star review.
I do always listen to podcasts, and when I do, I listen to this one because the guests are all my favorite people, and Ken Ford has a voice that's rich and sophisticated like an expensive glass of red wine and smooth as melted chocolate.
Melted chocolate. That guy really wanted a shirt.
Thank you, CCK197, and the thousands of other STEM Talk listeners who have helped make STEM Talk a great success right out of the gate. Okay, now on to today's interview with Dr. Kirk Parsley.
Fasten your seatbelts.
Dr. Kirk Parsley is a former Navy SEAL and a graduate of the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences. He served as the Undersea Medical Officer at Naval Special Warfare Group 1 from June 2009 through January of 2013. Additionally, he served as Naval Special Warfare's expert on sleep medicine and is a member of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. Dr. Parsley has lectured extensively on sleep, wellness, and hormonal optimization. He is currently completing a book on sleep optimization.
STEM Talk.
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 Okay, so today I'd like to welcome to STEM Talk Dr. Kirk Parsley. Kirk, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I thank you for having me on. I feel very welcome. I think actually we're digging out podcasts to sort of put them all in one spot for the relaunch of my website. And I think that this will have the distinction of being my 100th podcast.
Oh, wow. We're honored.
Yeah.
Did you hear the clap from everybody here?
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
Well, awesome. So you have an incredibly unique background. Can you talk about your transition from military to medicine to the research that you're doing now?
Sure. I think incredibly might be Yeah, a bit exaggerated there, but I appreciate that. Yeah, so I mean, I actually I guess the whole story really starts with me, leaving high school and going to be a SEAL. This well before the SEALs had any sort of publicity or fame. Nobody really knew what a SEAL was, but I'd read about it in a book, and it's supposed to be like the toughest training in the world, and I wanted to go do it. So I did that. I was in the military for just a little under 7 years. And then I quickly realized that that was a young single man's job, and I was becoming neither. And so I needed to do something else with my life, and thought I would be a physical therapist. The girl I was dating at the time was getting her master's degree in physical therapy, and I read a bunch of her books, and I liked the kind of stuff she studied, and it was, things that I've always been interested in. I've always read on health and nutrition and biomechanics and fitness and, exercise physiology and all that stuff. And so I thought, that's a good fit. And so I started working at San Diego Sports Medicine Center. I started volunteering to get my 2,000 volunteer hours necessary to even apply for PT school. And pretty quickly realized that that field wasn't exactly for me. It was a little too limited in its scope. And we had all sorts of other healthcare practitioners, and I just kind of got to shadow a bunch of people and decided, medicine was the way for me. And I was already married and I had kids, and so as I started applying to medical school, I was taking all of that into consideration, to try to not completely kill my wife while I was in medical school by overworking her. I knew I just wouldn't have a whole lot of time to be helpful. And I found out that the military had its own medical school. And although I wasn't like overjoyed to be going back into the military, it was a really good deal. So they were going to pay me to go to medical school instead of the other way around. And I figured I would, part of that deal is, they paid me to go to medical school and then I have to be a doctor for them for 8 years. But I figured I would get back to the SEAL teams, and I did. And so, as I was serving out my 8 years, I spent the last four of that with the SEALs. And I got there at a great time when this initiative they'd been working on for several years had finally come to fruition, and they were actually going to build this sports medicine complex, and it was going to be the very first sort of sports medicine facility they had on the West Coast. And they were actually building a gym at the same time that actually, all the SEAL teams kind of had their own little prison gyms or garage gyms kind of things, and they were consolidating all into one place, and they were going to put trainers in there and strength and conditioning coaches and all that. And so I got to be there right at the beginning of that and be a big part of that outgrowth. And we hired nutritionists and exercise physiologists and PTs and PT assistants and athletic trainers and all this, and then I was now the least qualified guy around, so they made me the manager and put me in charge of it. And but I had been a SEAL recently enough to where all of the SEALs still knew me, or not all of the SEALs, but a lot of the SEALs still knew me. And it's a very sort of word of mouth community about who you can trust and who you can't. And the SEALs would come in my office and shut the door and say, "Hey, man, let me tell you what my problems really are," because they don't want to tell the regular doctors because they could get disqualified and, they could get back to their leadership and they don't want to be looked down upon. And so they trusted me to keep things confidential. And I was completely ill-prepared for what they came to complain to me about. I had no idea. It led to what I do now, but through just, I guess very, very tangential ideas and topics and studies all kind of ultimately ended up with me focusing on adrenals, several other hormones involved in health and sleep, and how kind of all those things are tied together, and how I thought those things were leading to the problems that the SEALs were having. And the most palatable way in the military to talk about it was to talk about it through sleep. They didn't really want me talking about testosterone and, you know, and adrenal fatigue is kind of like a pseudoscience kind of definition. Mm-hmm. So I could talk about sleep. And so inadvertently, I became a sleep guy. And so and now I still study and read about sleep, you know, every day, and I present on it and I write about it. And, you know, the interesting thing is now that I do find sleep very interesting. And, I think I've really reached a point where I'm drinking my own Kool-Aid, with everything that I've been teaching people. I don't think that there's any area of your life that isn't significantly impacted by sleep. And if you're not sleeping well, I really think that's the first step. I would put it above nutrition. I would put it above exercise. I'd put it above, you know, anything that you can do. Mm-hmm. You know, proper sleep, you know, good quality and sufficient sleep is probably, you know, the most important elixir there is.
Yeah, what's interesting is, you know, you talk about things that we can control kind of on a daily basis, so nutrition, exercise, but sleep, comparatively speaking, gets very little coverage, both on the research side of things and also just in the public interest side of things. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't really know. I have a few theories, but I mean, it seems to me that telling people to sleep more should be as easy as selling sex. I mean, it's a fun thing to do. Like, it's enjoyable. It's a very normal activity. Feels good. Like, you know, everybody already does it. All I'm saying is do it a little more and do it a little better. Why is that such a big issue? Mm-hmm. But I think there's a couple of big obstacles. One, which I think, you know, not to be a conspiracy theorist or anything like this, but I think that, you know, sort of big industry, you know, and the industrialization of all of the industrialized countries, you know, they're kind of became this switch from, you know, living with the seasons and living with the sun to, you know, these factories that had artificial lighting and that ran 24 hours a day and mm-hmm. that was employing most of the people in this area. And so time became money. So the less you slept, the more you could work. The more you could work, the more money you could make, the more likely you would be able to buy your family a loaf of bread or whatever. And that's grown into, you know, sort of this, the mantras of American culture, at least. I know other countries are guilty of it as well, but you know, the whole idea of, you know, that if you're a really hard charger, you'll be the first one into the office and the last one out. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll get up super early and get your workout in before you start your 15-hour work day. You know, that sleep is for the weak, and you're really, you know, just suck it up and, you know, work harder and you'll get through. And, you know, a good friend of mine who's also a Navy SEAL, he just wrote a book, and he's been on lots of podcasts and so forth. And he has this thing called the 445 Club, and he has all these people following him on social media that are all aiming to be like him. And so they have to get up at no later than 4:45 in the morning and get their workout done, and you know, then press on through their day and work really hard and take responsibility for everything in their life and this whole thing. And you know, his message is extreme, but it's very normal. It's like the normal extreme. Mm-hmm. Like my message is on the other side of the extreme spectrum, is like, hey, you don't need to work so hard. You don't need to work that many hours. Like, you can get more done if you sleep more and your brain's working better. You don't actually need to work, you know, 18 hours. You can get the same amount of work done in 14 hours. And so you can sleep 2 extra hours and you know, you've gained 2 hours to your life. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. I mean, it's not what people are used to hearing. It's not what social rhetoric is. And so, you know, it's no different than, you know, telling people that, you know, bacon's actually a pretty good food. You know, I mean, what are people's reaction to that? They're like, what, are you crazy? You know, that'll kill you right at the breakfast table. I know I should eat whole grain cereal with fruits and berries and yogurt on it or whatever. Mm-hmm. So in some respect, it goes against social rhetoric. I think that's a problem. But I think the bigger problem for sleep is that we don't have nearly the objective experience of it that we have of all these other things. Mm-hmm. So when I tell you to work out X amount of time, X number of days, and do this, you know, this type of program, you know if you did it or not, right? And you have a very clear metric of whether or not you did it, and you know it made you feel a certain way, and you remember doing it, and you can see these little incremental gains in your performance or your body composition or whatever it is you're working towards. When I tell you, you know, to, you know, improve the quality of sleep, improve the length of your sleep. Well, once you fall asleep until the time you wake up, you don't really have any objective experience of that. So mm-hmm. you kind of wake up going, did I do that right? You know, and like, I don't know, like how long did you really sleep? I mean, people can wake up, you know, by you know, when we do polysomnographs on people, we can detect people that are waking up 300 times a night and then they'll wow. say, you ask them the next day how they slept. They're fine. Like I slept fine. And you ask them if they woke up. No, I don't remember waking up at all. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing about sleep is, you know, you don't need exactly the same amount of sleep every day. I mean, 7.5 hours is kind of the average point that we aim for. And we say, you know, that's really kind of the minimum likely, to be 7.5 hours. So, you know, just shoot for that number. But, you know, some days, like if you slept 8 hours every day, some days you're going to wake up in the morning feeling exhausted after sleeping 8 hours. And some days you're going to wake up super refreshed, especially at the beginning if you've been chronically sleep deprived for a while. Because mm-hmm. you are changing some mechanisms and you are actually enhancing your immune system, which is then going to go towards, you know, fixing lots of things that have just kind of been neglected by your physiology because you didn't have the, you know, the resources to work with it. So, you know, it's not like, you know, I think it's like the problem with taking vitamins, right? It's like you take your vitamins every day, but can you really tell if you took your vitamins?
Yeah.
Not necessarily, but sleep, you can tell to some extent, but it's not like this, oh, wow, experience. Like, man, I feel so much better until you've done it for maybe a month. And then you look back at who you were and you're like, I don't even know that person. That's ridiculous that I was functioning that way before.
I think there are wearables out there. Can you talk a little bit about them and how good are they at measuring the quality of sleep that we get?
I'll be super simplistic with it, but there's really kind of two different flavors of wearables. One is like your very basic thing, like the Fitbit and the Jawbone and kind of the ones that have been around. If you think of the ones that have been around for, I don't know, probably close to 10 years at this point, what those are measuring is actigraphy. So they're just measuring how much you move. And based on how much you move, there's a little, you know, a little accelerometer in there. So based on how much you're moving, how frequently you're moving, how quickly you're moving, they're determining whether you're asleep or not.
Okay.
And then, you know, if movement is sort of really low and lethargic and slow when you do move, they're like, okay, you're in deep sleep, you're in slow wave sleep cycles. If movement is absolutely completely absent, then they're saying, okay, you're in REM sleep because you're completely paralyzed during REM sleep. So you would be in REM sleep at that point. Now, the truth of the matter is that you could lay down in your bed, stare at your ceiling for 8 hours, never go to sleep, but never move, and it would say you got like this awesome night of sleep. So, you know, there's some utility to them, but they're not great. Now, the second category would be the devices that are now starting to add other features on there. So something I'm sure you're really familiar with is heart rate variability. Mm-hmm. So now some of them are built in to be able to detect heart rate variability. There's some other devices that aren't necessarily wearables, but you know, things you stick under your pillow or under your mattress or on your nightstand that are actually getting your respiratory rate as well. And then some that through speakers on little like things like iPhones or little electronic devices like that are capturing snoring as well. And so they're becoming more and more sophisticated, and the more sophisticated they become, the closer they're getting to the polysomnograph, which is the gold standard for determining how much somebody sleeps. So if somebody's willing to to mess around with these devices, then that can be like a little metric for them. Now, when I work with people, what everybody's interested in is completely personal, right? Mm-hmm. Like everybody has their own thing. So I don't care what your metric is. Of course, I don't only work with people for sleep, but some people specifically will approach me for sleep. And so we'll find a metric and how you feel throughout the day, like, what's your mood like? What's your energy level like? What's your communication like? How irritable are you? If that's their problem, if they feel like, they're a raging bitch all the time, or they're a raging prick and I'm always angry at everybody. We can work on that. If they're performance oriented around physicality, if they compete in any kind of sports, we can use those as metrics. We can mm-hmm. use their workouts as metrics. If they're in the sort of corporate world, we can work, we can measure their productivity. If they're entrepreneurs, we can, measure, you could probably measure cash flow. I've never gone that far, but I usually measure project completion rate relative to mm-hmm. when you're not sleeping as much as you should, and also how you feel about it, because sleep deprivation leads to anxiety, which is a big problem for entrepreneurs already. So
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
So let's just talk about an optimal night of sleep. So if you got the quote-unquote perfect night of sleep, what are the cycles that we go through?
When we do the polysomnograph, we put all those electrodes all over your brain, and we measure your heart rate, we measure your respiratory rate, and we measure your red blood cell oxidation, the pulse ox, they call it. All of that data, the polysomnograph itself, I think 12 leads of EEG, that just looks like complete spaghetti. Like, it's a completely nonsensical scribbling, unless you are, a sleep tech or a physician who's learned how to read these things. Mm-hmm. But when we combine all of that together, we get what we call a hypnogram, which is what most people are thinking of when they're thinking of the stages of sleep, mm-hmm. Which is a very sort of blocked off linear little up and down graph, and when you look at that as the example, the stage one sleep essentially is just like the decision to go in bed, to get in bed and try to start falling asleep. You're not at all asleep. You might feel slightly more relaxed or whatever, but you're completely awake. You're still completely aware of your environment. You're just kind of slowing down and getting in that phase. Stage two is really kind of the pre-sleep, where you're not quite asleep, but you're not quite awake, and like you're somewhat aware of your environment, not really aware of your environment. I don't want to get too technical with this, but there are some specific little EEG changes that we look for in stage two sleep to tell us that certain things are going on. One of the things we think is going on in stage two is that it kind of triggers memories of events during the day that are helping you go towards long-term potentiation, or we call it durable memory tract formation. And then you'll pass through stage two sleep and go into the what we call deep sleep, which is stage three and four, which are stages delta and theta brainwaves. And what happens in the deep sleep, so the way the night's sort of broken up is, let's say you sleep 8 hours a night. Predominantly, the first 4 hours of night are going to be deep sleep. The second half of the night predominantly is going to be REM sleep. So your REM cycles get progressively longer and your deep sleep cycles get progressively shorter throughout the night. Hmm. But what happens in the stages three and four of sleep is exactly the opposite of the fight or flight. So if you think about everything that goes on when an animal hits fight and flight, all of the physiological changes, now we're in exactly the opposite. You are secreting maximal growth hormone, you're secreting maximal testosterone, your immune system is working at its highest, highest possible function during that portion of the night. You're repairing damage to your body. As most people know, you actually get stronger from exercise and working out by slightly damaging your muscles and connective tissue and then building them back a little thicker and a little more resilient, a little more durable, which can, be a little more enduring if you're an endurance athlete, or a little thicker and more robust if you're a strength athlete. So all of that's really happening during stages 3 and 4 of sleep, and it's really, this is a slight oversimplification, but I think you could really say that's really the only time that your body is actually repairing is during stages 3 and 4 sleep, with the deep sleep cycle. So if you're missing out on that, which, some over-the-counter drugs mess with that, some over-the-counter sleep drugs will mess with stages 3 and 4 sleep, drinking alcohol as a sleep aid messes with stages 3 and 4 sleep. And then, as I said, you'll come out of that deep sleep, you'll go back through stage 2, then you'll go into REM sleep. And REM sleep, as most people will know, stands for rapid eye movement. It's just one of those job security kind of phrases that physicians use to make us sound smart. And all it does is describe what people saw when they first started doing sleep medicine. It's like, hey, their eyes are moving around rapidly. Let's call that rapid eye movement and abbreviate it REM, and nobody will know what we're talking about. And it, just kind of became jargon that way. But it really just started as a pure observation. We had no idea what was going on. Now we think that that's where a lot of emotional categorization is going on. That's where the most vivid dreaming is going on. There's different philosophies about dreaming, whether or not it's completely random or if it is actually a way to, work through emotional and, psychological sort of issues that have been going on in your life. And then, like I said, you'll progressively do more and more REM throughout the night, which is why people who sleep adequately tend to say they dream a lot, because they've gotten lots of REM and they're most likely to wake up during REM. It's really, really hard to wake up during stages 3 and 4 sleep, deep sleep, because your adrenal function is at, absolutely at its nadir. Your cortisol is completely through the floor. All of your wake-promoting neurotransmitters are down. Your other adrenal hormones that lead to you being awake, epinephrine and norepinephrine and aldosterone and all those types of things. Even thyroid function is suppressed during this stages 3 and 4 sleep. So if you try to wake up in that deep sleep cycle, that's why some people feel horrible when they wake up in the morning. So you're still getting some deep sleep cycles later on in the second half of the night, just like you're getting some REM in the first half of the night. So you could get a great night's sleep, but wake up during a deep sleep cycle and you're just going to feel bad. It's going to be really hard to work. It's going to be really hard to wake up. And you're going to have to kind of ramp your adrenal function up but it should happen pretty quickly if you've gotten adequate sleep and you've routinely gotten adequate sleep.
So is there any way that you can ensure that you don't wake up and deep sleep and wake up during REM?
Yeah, there are some devices to help with that. Obviously the way we evolved and the most simplistic way to do that is to wake up without an alarm clock, which isn't an option for most people. but if you have that luxury just by not setting an alarm clock, you're not just going to pop awake during a deep sleep cycle. It's not going to happen. You're going to wake up during a REM cycle. But there are some devices that use that accelerometry technology to predict, to the best they can, that you're now in a REM sleep cycle or a lighter stage, and that can be predicted not only by your actual movement, but just by let's say that X is happening, this device is measuring X and it determines that to be your slow wave sleep cycle or deep cycles. And then that should get progressively shorter throughout the night. And so that, you know, by the morning time, this device has said, yeah, okay, that's definitely when you're in deep sleep. So we're going to wake you up when you're not in that phase. And so you can set your alarm clock, I think, anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour variance, and just say, wake me up at the lightest possible phase during that. And this alarm will go off when you're in a lighter phase of sleep.
Hmm. Interesting.
There's an iPhone app that does that. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. I can remember what the icon looks like, but I don't remember the name. I think it's called Sleep Cycles, actually.
That would make sense. So, you know, there's been recent research on the glymphatic system, so kind of the brain's, you know, ability to flush out kind of the toxins and the junk in the brain. And they say that specifically it probably kicks in when we're sleeping. Would that probably be happening during stage 3-4 sleep, or do we know any of that yet?
Yeah, so that happens much more in the beginning parts of the night. I think it's actually happening. It's actually happening because of neurotransmitter changes in the brain, not nearly as much because of the other hormonal changes. I think it's specifically the neurotransmitters. And what's happening is that the actual structural cells of the brain, that, you know, the kind of the scaffolding that holds the whole thing together, those structural cells actually contract, and they contract and essentially reduce their size by about 30%. And when they reduce their size by 30%, it just kind of opens up all the pathways for all of the, you know, for all of the neurons. It gets, you know, more space in between these. And of course, there's always, you know, fluid in between there because it's all bathed in CNS, and that's, in fact, you know, the medium that, you know, your neurons are communicating through. You know, there has to be sort of this liquid involved. And lots of inflammatory products build up in our brain throughout the day. And then there's also a byproduct of our energy utilization system. The breakdown of ATP ultimately becomes adenosine. And adenosine actually causes sleep pressures. You know, if you're in really tense sort of cognitive activity, like, you know, grad school or something, you're using your brain just to a much higher level than most of the time, mm-hmm. most of the rest of the time in your life. And you'll build up a bunch of adenosine that way as well. And that's why when we've really had a hard day, we really feel like sleeping, all right? It's like, I just can't wait to get to bed. And it's a different sensation than when you've had sort of an easy, cruisy day and it's just like time for bed. It's like, oh man, I'm sinking into the bed and I got to go out right now. Mm-hmm. That's what we call sleep pressure, and that's driven by adenosine. So as soon as your brain sort of flushes out adenosine, and there's other inflammatory products, there's interleukin 6, there's TNF alpha, like there's other just like inflammatory markers that we know are building up because of just sort of the process of being awake and the oxidation that goes on with neuronal activity, burning, you know, glucose and all that type of stuff. These structural cells contract, that they allow this, you know, sort of passageway, allows the CNS to circulate a little more freely. It flushes out these toxins. And what you find a lot of times is a lot of people, especially C-level executives, you know, people trying to make partner at their firm and entrepreneurs and these type of people that just work these ridiculously hard, driven schedules, they'll fall asleep really easily. And they'll fall asleep really easily because they have a ton of sleep pressure. But they also have a ton of stress in their life, and they have a ton of adrenal function, and they have lots of cortisol, and they have lots of epinephrine, which is just adrenaline. They have a lot of these adrenal hormones circulating through their body. So as soon as they flush out all of the, you know, the neurotoxins and the adenosine, and all of that kind of comes back to normal, then their adrenal function, all of this excessive adrenal function, actually wakes them up. So these people are notorious for saying, I fall asleep in 30 seconds, I sleep for 2 hours, and I'm wide awake. And then I start worrying about everything that I'm doing, everything I have to do, every mistake I could have possibly made. And, you know, And those, you know, that's a really common pattern. I see that a lot.
That's really interesting. That has that biochemical basis. And the other interesting thing is it sounds like the body is kind of set up to do all, at least get through the main functions to kind of help things keep operating as best possible. Get all of that out of the way first. and then you know, you transition into REM sleep, which is not as... Not as imperative, I guess, for the brain and for the body to function properly.
Yeah, not for just pure survival. You have to really get you have to make sure your body's repaired, right? And of course, we like to think of ourselves as being this unique species, but we're just an animal. There's lots of other animals on the planet, and we are the only animal that sleep deprives ourselves on purpose. But other animals will sleep deprive themselves. When they are being stalked by a predator, or if their brain senses famine, like impending famine or current famine. And so it would make sense that, okay, if, you know, not, and obviously there's a wide spectrum as to how much each animal needs to sleep, but we'll use the human animal as our example. You know, if we were, you know, still sort of in our hunter gatherer phase and, food was becoming more and more scarce, and you needed to get out, you know, the next day, you know, to be able to go further, to be able to, you know, forage for more food or find more animals to travel greater distances throughout your day, then it makes sense that you're going to sleep deprive yourself a little bit, but you're going to repair the body, and the body will be nice and strong. You know, maybe you can't, you know, interpret, you know, cave markings as well as, you know, your fellow cavemen who've been sleeping 8 hours. But that's really kind of what you're losing, is that fine tuning executive functioning stuff as sort of a one off or a short period. Now, when you chronically sleep deprive yourself, you know, it's actually interesting, you know, whether you're going to bed really late, if you're sleep depriving yourself because you're going to bed really late, or you're sleep depriving yourself because you're waking up really early, it actually has slightly different effects on your sleep and you know how rapidly sort of each aspect of you breaks down. But you know, the way most people sleep deprive themselves is getting up excessively early. And so when you get up excessively early, what you're really giving up is your prefrontal cortex, which is the same area of your brain that's impaired when you drink alcohol. So your ability to make decisions, solve problems, you know, predict the most likely outcome of your decision, you know, fine motor skills, coordination, reaction time, attention span, all of that stuff is sort of that prefrontal cortex, what we call executive functioning. And that's the most impaired aspect with just a single night of short sleep. If you chronically sleep deprive yourself, you kind of get all the bad stuff. You know, because you get chronic inflammation, your body quits repairing, it decreases insulin sensitivity, it decreases testosterone and growth hormone production, you become less anabolic, your body doesn't even repair, even though you're kind of getting maybe adequate deep sleep. And a lot of that has to do with when you sleep deprive yourself, you have to secrete additional adrenal hormones, which are stress hormones. You have to secrete those in order to get through the day, because your normal fuel systems aren't there. So you're having to sort of get by on that. And then, of course, it leads to people using stimulants, and oftentimes in an unwise fashion. And, you know, that just adds fuel to the fire, and so on and so forth.
You just get caught in a really bad cycle. You know, you always hear about people say, well, so-and-so never needs sleep. He can get by on 4.5 hours of sleep a night. And so, you know, it's like, oh, it must be genetic. Is there any kind of role? It seems like it's pretty consistent that we all probably need about the same amount of sleep. It's just some people might be able to handle it better than others. Is that kind of the difference?
Yeah. So, I mean, I can't speak to that absolutely, because nobody's done sort of the definitive trials on this. But there's kind of two different bodies of knowledge on this as to how we've come about it. So, there's been lots of sleep work where we do what we call a sleep adaptation to people, and the sleep adaptation is basically we put people in these bunkers or, you know, old military barracks with completely, you know, blacked out windows, or I don't know. I think they've even used like some prisons or something. I don't know. But these really dark controlled rooms where they only have a bed and a toilet and that's it. And you put them in a cool dark room for 14 hours a day. You let them out for 10 hours a day. They have to go back in the room for 14 hours a day. And what we found on average, and this has been done many, many times across many cultures, lots of scientists have done this. What we find is that the average person who's running around, even if they report having pretty good sleep, but they're running around living sort of the normal Western industrialized lifestyle, they'll sleep about 12 and a half hours per day when the study first starts. And then progressively over, they'll sleep less and less each night over the course of maybe 3 to 4 weeks. And then they all get down to sleeping right around 7.5 hours, plus or minus 30 minutes. And that's been bore out over and over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And then when we take that completely sleep-adapted person and then we give them some sort of test and we start measuring performance, and we call that their baseline, as soon as we take a couple of hours of sleep away from them and then have them test the next day, they will do worse. But they'll know they did worse, right? They'll realize that they did worse because they'll say, oh, I felt really tired. And then day two, the same thing happens. And then day three and four, somewhere around there, they'll start saying that they feel like they've completely adapted to this new schedule. They don't feel tired anymore, and they think they did as well as they've ever done. But the problem is that their results are continuing to get worse. Their performance is still deteriorating, and it's actually going up. So actually, every night that they sleep 6 hours, their performance is actually getting worse every single morning when you test them. Hmm. And this can be done with anything, like literally anything. You can do it with strength, endurance, coordination, playing the piano, juggling, like it doesn't matter. You can do it with problem solving, reaction time, typing speed, anything, like anything you want to do, like any type of metric, people will progressively get worse and worse and worse. Till after about 11 days of sleeping 6 hours a night, you will perform exactly as though you haven't slept for 24 hours. And then after about 22 days of sleeping 6 hours a night, you will perform as though you haven't slept for 48 hours.
Wow.
And by the way, the sort of the equivalent of being awake for 24 hours, the equivalent, that's an equivalent performance to a blood alcohol level of 0.1, mm-hmm. which is legitimately intoxicated.
Yeah.
Now, the other body of data that's just recently going against that is, it's come out because it's become so much easier to sequence people's DNA and for people to get their own genome. And so people are really looking hard for utility to the science, I think. Mm-hmm. And so there have been people who come in and report that I don't need sleep. Like I only need 4 hours of sleep or 6 hours of sleep, whatever. And then they study these people's genes and they go, oh, well, this person actually has these three modifications to the genes that we know are associated with sleep. So we think that this is probably like a genetic variant that allows this person to not sleep nearly as much as everyone else. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, I have not seen them try to sleep adapt these people and do the study. But I can tell you that in all the trials that have been done, none of those people happened to be in those trials.
Right,
because everybody ended up at 7.5 hours of sleep. There wasn't anybody who, after they sleep adapted for 3 or 4 weeks, was sleeping 4 hours a night and bouncing up and going, yep, I'm up.
There wasn't an outlier in that population.
Those outliers didn't exist. Now, I'm not saying those outliers don't exist. Mm-hmm. The data that I think has been relatively well fleshed out is that there are sort of some genetic markers and genetic sequences, and I don't know what they are because I don't study genomics at all. But there definitely are some genetic links to people who do not suffer as badly as the average person when they deprive themselves a few hours of sleep. They're still not optimal.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's proven that they're still performing at their best, that they don't perform better when they get adequate sleep. But they've shown that, well, their performance doesn't deteriorate as quickly. So it's kind of like being the son of an alcoholic and saying, I can drink 6 beers and be fine, whereas most people can only drink 3.
Right.
I'm still affected by alcohol and it's still probably not a good idea. And if, we're still getting to the same deleterious point, just through more beers. So
yeah, you're still not functioning at optimal capacity compared to you know, I guess where things could be if you actually were getting a good night's sleep. So that's really interesting.
That little nuance is what it's kind of the thing I like to shock people with. And it was in my TED talk, but I've used it in several lectures as well, is that, you know, if you were about to have surgery and the surgeon came over to meet you and have you sign consent forms and so forth, and then while you're reading the forms, he poured a shot of whiskey and tossed it back and then said, all right, you know, are you all done with this forms? You're ready to go? Like, nobody would be comfortable with that. There's not a person on the planet that I've met so far that was like, yeah, cool, no problem. They'd be like, no way, I don't want this guy doing surgery on me. But yet, if, you know, if this guy only takes like one shot every 2 hours, he is performing just the same as somebody who's been up for 18 hours in a row. Mm-hmm. And we accept that all the time. We accept, you know, we put surgeons into surgery who have been awake for 30 hours. Mm-hmm. You know, we put pilots up in the air who have, you know, been sleep deprived for the last four nights in a row. And, you know, the FAA is a lot better than that at that than the military, or I'm sorry, than the medical community about regulating that. But, you know, it still happens all the time, especially with transcontinental pilots. You know, just because they give them enough time to get that much sleep doesn't mean that they actually get that much sleep once they start, you know, adding, you know, their shuffling around the airport, taking their shuttle back to their hotel, checking into their room, winding down, getting to sleep, and then getting up, you know, the next day. A lot of the times they're sleep deprived. And my mom's a flight attendant, so I know this, and she, you know, she's sleep deprived every trip she goes on. Mm-hmm. And she's an older woman, so it's not like she's gone out partying. It's like, you know, as soon as she gets home, as soon as she gets to her hotel, she goes to sleep. And still there's plenty of times where she's only getting 5 or 6 hours a night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting because it goes back to the whole point that you made about kind of this cultural aspect for as to why, you know, we as a society don't get enough sleep, as specifically in some of these sub-communities. You know, in the medical field, I know, you know, they've put restrictions with respect to hours, even for surgeons. And, you know, even though those restrictions are there, there's still this mentality within that community of, okay, well, I don't have to work hours in the operating room, or I don't have to be in the ICU with my patients per se, but I can take that extra time that I now have. And, yeah, you know, there's still, it's like, oh, now I'm going to do research. Now I'm going to write papers. Now I'm going to, you know, do X, Y, and Z, because I, you know, there's still this kind of mentality of like, the more you're working, you know, the less you're sleeping, the tougher you are, the better you are. And yeah, how you change that, I don't know.
And the other thing that they didn't address, you know, I mean, I think it says something that it takes the threat of congressional action for any type of professional body to say, okay, well, we won't work our people 120 hours a week. You know, like, I mean, that's crazy enough. But, you know, what they didn't address when they said, okay, we're going to reduce the number of hours that you can work people, they didn't address the fact that the same amount of work still needs to be done.
Right.
And so, you know, what by and large happens is that things that can be done outside of the hospital get done outside of the hospital. And so they kick you out of the hospital at a certain time, but then you just have to go home and, you know, finish doing that work, mm-hmm. you know. Especially with electronic medical records, a lot of times, you know, these are cloud-based, and you can go home and you can keep charting, and you can go home and do the assigned reading that you need, you know, for, you know, whatever lectures are coming up, or you can work, like you said, on your presentation or your research or whatever it is that you were going to do anyways and that you would have done in the hospital. You're just going to do at home now, because you still have to have the same number of hours of people grinding away on all of the day-to-day work and treating the patients. And if they wanted to truly address that, they would have had to, you know, expand the workforce of every hospital that agreed to decrease the number of hours that their people were working. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that nobody wants to do that, because that means fewer medical schools and fewer medical centers and all that type of stuff, which means less profit. And again, not to be a conspiracy theorist, but, you know, medicine's about money, just like every other profession. And not necessarily for the people doing the service, but the people who, you know, are running the organizing it.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience. So you were talking about sleep medications like Ambien, Lunesta, some of these different types of prescribed medications or even over-the-counter medications that are out there. And you said that they interrupt, you know, things like stage 3-4 sleep, which are so important for our bodies and kind of the repair mode. Why are they so controversial and why is it that they don't really seem to help us get the proper sleep that we need?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think sort of the short answer to that is that there are literally thousands of things going on in your brain in order for your brain and body to go to sleep appropriately. And then those thousands of things are changing multiple times throughout the night because as you go through these different sleep cycles, they're changing to keep you asleep, and then eventually they're changing to wake you up. You know, every sleep drug that's out there is working on one trick. It's like out of these thousand things going on, we're going to say this is the most important one, and we're going to focus on that. You know, that neurotransmitter, a big one that a lot of the pharmaceuticals go after is GABA. So they do things that are GABA analogs. So things like the benzodiazepines, things like Valium and Xanax. These are molecules that competitively bind where GABA would ordinarily bind on neurons, and they have an effect that's much stronger than GABA. And GABA is sort of a sedating neurotransmitter. It slows things down. It lowers the resting potential of the neuron so that it's harder for that neuron to fire. The Z drugs also are GABA analogs, and what the Z drugs do, I've seen data of the Z drugs messing with stages 3 and 4 sleep. I've seen other data that says it doesn't mess with stages 3 and 4 sleep. I can tell you every patient that I have that's taken a sleep study on a Z drug hasn't had adequate stages 3 and 4 sleep, and some of them have had none. I've had patients with 99% stage 2 sleep throughout the night while using a sleep drug. But we know for a fact that the Z drugs definitely interfere with REM sleep, and they decrease REM sleep by about 80%. So what happens even if you stay in bed for 8 hours, and by the way, the pharmaceutical industry gets to cherry pick their data and present best case scenario. And so one would think that these things, in order for the FDA to approve them, they would have to have a significant benefit to outweigh the risk of them. But you know, the truth about Z drugs is that they will shorten the time it takes you to fall asleep by about 15 minutes, and they will result in about 30 extra minutes of sleep. But if they are destroying your sleep architecture, you definitely are getting far less sleep than if you wouldn't have used the sleep drug, and you would have slept maybe only, you know, even if you would have slept an hour less or 2 hours less, you probably would get more sleep by not using the sleep drug. And then, you know, the over-counter ones tend to focus on histamine. Histamine is one of the wake-promoting neurotransmitters in your brain, and it just essentially goes in there and, you know, blocks histamine receptors and prevents histamine from binding. And these are things that are like in Benadryl, and they're in lots of cold medicines and so forth like that. Mm-hmm. And alcohol is as I described, affects stages 3 and 4 of sleep, and has some effect on REM sleep as well. But you know, basically, it's like I don't have a great metaphor for it, but it's just way too complex of a series of events, constantly in flux for you to just go in there and like pick one little thing out of it and say that, you know, this is the one thing that we're going to do, and that's going to allow normal sleep to happen. Because mm-hmm. as soon as you mess with one of those things, you've messed with every other thing.
Right.
You can't just change one without impacting the way every other neurotransmitter is now working and every other brain region is firing and all of that. So they're just suboptimal. They're great for sort of realigning, you know, realigning circadian rhythms. If you're doing transcontinental flying or something, you know, I don't have any problems with people using sleep drugs to get back on track more quickly. They're great if, you know, you've had a traumatic accident, a death in the family or something, and you know, just for pure emotional reasons, you can't sleep for a week. It's better than no sleep whatsoever. But most people, you know, the research shows that most people who take sleep drugs, I think 69% of people who take sleep drugs take it every night. They take it year round. And there's some pretty damning research on that. I think it's either it shortens your life. You know, this one trial that was done recently determined that it shortened your life. It was either an average of 14 or 17 years it took off your life to be using sleep drugs every night. My hypothesis is that it probably is not the sleep drugs themselves. It's the fact that these people were sleep deprived for that many years. Because what's really happening is what these drugs do is they dissociate your brain essentially from you, your lizard brain from your neocortex. They kind of dissociate those two, so you don't have any memory of what was going on. So you feel like you were asleep all of that time, but you didn't necessarily sleep at all. I mean, you could literally, you know, take one of these drugs and do anything. And there's lots of stories of people doing that, you know, going out and driving their cars and going to the store and buying food and coming home and cooking it and getting back in bed and thinking they slept all night and then waking up to a mess and going, you know, where did all this come from? Because they just have no memories. Their brain has been dissociated. But that's not the same thing as sleep. It's closer to being knocked unconscious. You know, somebody hit you in the head with a baseball bat, you wouldn't say, I fell asleep after that guy hit me.
Right.
Yeah, you're knocked unconscious. It's a different state.
Yeah, I've definitely heard some stories. I think we all have of people on Ambien and some of these other sleep drugs. So, so with that in mind, what are some natural ways that you would recommend for promoting proper sleep?
I think the most important thing is to convince people that they need sleep. to convince people that, okay, yes, you are a unique snowflake, but you know. All snowflakes melt the same, and you're just going to be a puddle of water if you don't do, you know, if you don't do this. And so, you know, if people will prioritize sleep and just give it a chance, give it a reasonable chance to change their lives, everybody will be convinced. Like every single person will go, "Oh my God, I can't believe I was doing that before." I mean, it's like. That was a crass metaphor I was going to come up with. I'll skip that. But you know, it's just something. It's just like the alcohol I was talking about. You know, it's like we lose our self awareness when we're sleep deprived. It's just like being mildly intoxicated. So we think we're fine until we're completely sober, and then we go, "Oh yeah, I was a little buzzed. I definitely shouldn't have been doing what I was doing."
Yeah.
That's why I said that really stupid thing. So that's the same thing. If people will prioritize sleep, they will recognize after some people one night, like I slept great, I feel like a different person the next day. Some people it's a week, some people it's 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I've never seen anyone that it takes more than a month. But definitely after you slept well for a month, you can look back to who you were, how you used to function, and you'll just be amazed. And this is, of course, if you're chronically sleep deprived. So first thing is to prioritize sleep. And then the second thing is to actually ritualize sleep. So if you value sleep, you're going to treat it like anything else you value. So people who value fitness don't just, you know, go to the gym and just randomly lift weights, right? They have a plan, or right, they have a schedule that they're keeping to. They have certain things that they're aiming for. You have to do the same thing with sleep. Of course, anybody who's had a kid or anybody who's been a kid will remember that there's, you know, we have sleep rituals when we're kids, and like there's this kind of quiet time where we start slowing down their activities so that they're not all ramped up, and then, you know, we give them a bath, and then we put on their jammies, and you powder them up, and you put them in their bed, and then you read the bedtime story, and then you play with the little stuffed animals, and then you turn off the light, and you tuck them in, and whatever, and like there's this whole ritual that goes on every single night for this kid to be able to go to sleep. And adults are no different. And so people can't work on their computers until 9:59 and then hop in bed at 10 o'clock and expect to be to sleep, you know, within a few minutes and, you know, get up at 6 and go, I got 8 hours of sleep. It doesn't work that way. It's like your brain has to slow down. So there's two things that are really letting our brain know whether or not we should be awake. One of those things is light, and the other things is activity. So if you're, you know, no matter how drunk you are and how late it is, if you're in a really loud club with music and, you know, lots of people, you know, screaming and dancing around you and all this stuff, bright lights flashing, you're not going to go to sleep. You're not going to fall asleep in a club. I mean, I guess you could, but it's very unlikely that you would. And that's because your brain is stimulated. So you have to decrease the stimulation to your brain at least an hour before bed. And I recommend, you know, doing things like, you know, meditating or stretching or some light yoga, or if you're into Tai Chi or anything like that, anything that's just kind of relaxing, not super stimulating. You can even read. I would recommend reading a physical book as opposed to some sort of backlit screen. But definitely, you know, you have to quit working. You have to quit doing anything that, you know, you have to quit arguing with your wife. You have to, you know, quit, you know, doing dishes or cleaning the house or whatever. You can't do any of that stuff. You have to disengage. And then the other thing is that, you know, the way we're programmed to live on this planet and live with the days and live in the seasons is by light saturation in our eyes. And what happens to our ancestors, and that still happens today, and the people that live like, you know, the traditional hunters and gatherers that we evolved from, is about 3.5 hours after the sun goes down, you feel like going to sleep. And that's because when the light decreases in your eyes, specifically the blue light decreases in your eyes, that leads to this really circuitous pathway. It affects what people have heard called the master clock. It's also called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is just another job security word. Master clock works just fine. It's a bundle of neurons in the middle of your brain that go out and change all those neurotransmitters I was talking about. One of the things that does is make a lot of that GABA neurotransmitter, which is the thing that's kind of slowing down your brain, which is lots of sleep drugs are trying to work like GABA, but more powerful than GABA, so you'll go to sleep faster. But the end of all this pathway is the production of melatonin, and melatonin leads to a lot of cascades of events. But one of the big things that it does is that melatonin suppresses adrenal functions, the adrenal hormones, and the actual adrenal function themselves. So both of those things need to happen for you to go to sleep. So you need to decrease light after sundown, or, you know, 3 hours before bed. You can do that by wearing glasses that block blue light, like gaming glasses block blue light. That's how they reduce the fatigue on your eyes. You can do that by, you know, there's Philips makes some light bulbs now that don't have any blue light in them. You can do it by simply dimming your lights. If you're going to be working on a computer, there's a program called F.LUX, that you program where you live, and then when the sun goes down, it will take all the blue light out of your screen. And then when the sun comes back up, it puts it all back in your screen. They have similar things for smartphones, although I think Apple's phone, you had to jailbreak to do it. But Apple's next version of the iPhone is actually going to have that program built in.
Oh, great.
And, you know, for televisions, I don't really have a great solution. I think the glasses are the best thing for television. That's what I do if I'm watching television, is just where I wear the gaming glasses. I actually wear shooting glasses, but it's the same thing. Yeah.
I don't always listen to podcasts, but when I do, I listen to STEM Talk, interviewing the most interesting people in the world of science and technology. Stay curious, my friends.
You talked about melatonin, so I know a lot of people think about taking a melatonin supplement to help sleep. What's your thought on that?
Again, melatonin is one I mean, it's actually a hormone, not a neurotransmitter, but mm-hmm. I guess it's still a, we won't get technical. So melatonin is a major hormone involved with falling asleep. The problem with melatonin is that most people take way too much melatonin. And then the other problem with melatonin is that it doesn't last in your bloodstream for a very long time. So if you're getting, you know, when you get something that's normally produced inside of your body, you get it from outside of your body and put it in your body, we call that exogenous administration. So when you get exogenous melatonin, if it's too much, just like if your body sees too much of any other kind of hormone, you will decrease your brain's sensitivity to melatonin. So mm-hmm. from the time the sun goes down, and that whole pathway begins that I was talking about until the time the sun wakes up or the sun comes up and you wake up and start getting a light in your eyes again, your brain will only produce about somewhere between 0.3, well, let's say it will produce somewhere between 3 and 6 micrograms of melatonin. A lot of these melatonin products you see are 10 milligrams of melatonin or 15 milligrams of melatonin. And I've seen 50 milligrams of melatonin.
Wow.
That's way, 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 way more than you need. And just like bodybuilders shut down their, you know, they shut down their body's ability to respond to testosterone because they take so much exogenously, they actually interfere with their own production as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, the science is kind of 50-50 as to whether or not your brain actually decreases melatonin production if you take it exogenously, but you definitely quit responding to it as well. And so that's why people take these really big doses, because if you take 50 milligrams and then say, I'm making this up, I don't know what the half-life of it is off the top of my head, but let's say the half-life is 2 hours. You know, 2 hours later, you still have 25 milligrams. 2 hours later, you're down to 12 and a half milligrams. You know, 2 hours later, you're down to 6.25 or whatever that would be.
Mm-hmm.
And so you always have more than you need. if you took the proper dose of melatonin and you just gave yourself a little dusting, like 3 micrograms or something, that would kind of initiate the cascades, but then it would kind of all flush out. And if your brain didn't continue to make melatonin, it would be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wouldn't really work. And that's why, that's why the sleep product that I made is really designed to help you make melatonin. And it just has like a tiny little bit of melatonin in it to kind of kickstart things. But really what you need to do is make sure that you're doing everything right for your brain to be ready to make melatonin, and then to make sure you don't have any sort of nutritional deficiencies that are, you know, keeping you from being able to make adequate melatonin.
And that's essentially what your sleep cocktail that you just mentioned, it's kind of encompasses all these things, that dusting of melatonin, as you put it, plus nutritional, supplements, I guess, if you want to say, into the sleep cocktail. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So it's you know, people have heard of the tryptophan coma, which, you know, comes, you know, around Thanksgiving and Christmas, so when you eat too much turkey. So it's just an amino acid that turkey happens to be rich in. Most meats are rich in it, but we just overeat turkey, so it's really sort of coincidental. But when you take in a bunch of tryptophan, it can, you know, kind of push this pathway. So the way it works in your brain is tryptophan becomes 5-hydroxytryptophan. 5-hydroxytryptophan becomes serotonin. Serotonin then becomes melatonin. One of the reasons we think that that sleep deprivation is associated with depression is because you can see in that pathway that if you weren't making, if this pathway wasn't working, you weren't making enough melatonin, but you had plenty of serotonin, your brain would strip the serotonin to make melatonin, and then you'd have a serotonin deficiency, which we know is associated with depression.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for that pathway to go to completion, it also requires a couple of cofactors. One is vitamin D3, which most people are deficient in unless they're taking supplements for it, and the other one is magnesium. And then so that's what's in my product. That's the main aspect of the product, is it just has all of those little ingredients in there. It doesn't have serotonin in it because, You can't just take serotonin. It doesn't work that way. But it has tryptophan, 5-hydroxytryptophan, vitamin D3, magnesium, and a little bit of melatonin in it. And then it has a GABA derivative in it that can actually cross the blood-brain barrier. So it's just GABA with this little phenol ring on it that allows it to cross the blood-brain barrier and get into the brain, because GABA otherwise doesn't get into the brain. If you take it exogenously, it doesn't get into the brain with any type of real reliability. So that's really it. And everything is at such a low dose that it's really kind of an initiation thing. Like, it really just kind of helps you get into sleep. So if you're just doing everything wrong and you're completely metabolically broken or something, it's not gonna allow you to sleep all night. It's just gonna kind of, help you get to sleep. So it's really meant to compensate for, just whatever is suboptimal about your sleep. Do you have a suboptimal sleep ritualization? Do you really not have control over sort of having a protracted sleep ritual before you go to bed? Do you have obligations where you just have to get up super early and you just physically can't get enough sleep? That's really what the product is for. But I always tell people the first thing is the lifestyle modification. Like, do all of that first. Work on your nutrition, work on your exercise, work on your sleep ritualization, and work on, controlling your stress. Those are the keys. The supplement is just that. It's supplemental to that, and it can help you sort of do that stuff. But it's not like a magical elixir.
Just knock you out and you have the best night of sleep in your life.
So. Yeah.
So Kirk, where can people find more information about your sleep cocktail? And also just, I know you have a blog, correct? On some of the work that you do?
Yeah. I have a website that I started a blog that I haven't really blogged that consistently with. But actually, I'm building up a big reserve of blogs right now. My website, docparsley.com, is going to it's still up and it's going, and people can go there to get information, and they can find my sleep product on there, and they can read some of my blogs, and they can see other podcasts and shows that I've done, and so forth. But that site is being redesigned and relaunched. And then I will actually have a regular blog at that point, because I'm building up a lot of reserves so that I don't actually have to sit down and write a blog every week. So we'll have like a continual rollout of blogs on that site. And the sleep product right now is called Doc Parsley Sleep Cocktail. But the URL for it is sleepcocktails.com, because the LA Times owns sleepcocktail.com and they have a lot more money than I do. So I assume I can get it from them. But that product's actually going to be renamed, because it turns out that Sleep Cocktail is a terrible name. A lot of people think it's actually an alcoholic drink. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of firewalls at corporations and government agencies and so forth and universities block it because of the word cocktail.
Interesting.
So from a marketing standpoint, it turns out to be a terrible name. It's just the name that the SEALs came up with. I developed it helping the SEALs correct their sleep problems. We just kind of developed it one supplement at a time. It started out with just vitamin D3, and then we just kind of kept adding things until we've got to the right dosage of everything. And they just started calling it the Parsley Cocktail. And so, when I formed the product, I knew nothing about being in business or marketing a product. And so I was like, all right, we'll call it the cocktail. Like, it's called the sleep cocktail. And just kind of it was born out of that. But yeah. We'll be renaming it and repackaging it with some prettier packaging that's, people like to see a little better than our kind of ugly packaging right now. So I would say probably go to docparsley.com, but the sleepcocktails.com will work. Well, that site will continue to work because it'll just keep redirecting people to Doc Parsley once we relaunch.
Okay. And then once you rename it, you'll have that up on the site.
Yes.
Awesome. Kirk, thank you so very much for joining us today on the podcast.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
Well, that was a fun and informative discussion. Lots of great information from Dr. Parsley was shared today.
Agreed. Kirk is a very interesting guy. It seems that you were barely able to scratch the surface of this critically important topic during your interview with Doc Parsley. I suspect that the double secret selection committee may invite him back for an encore interview.
Yeah, Kirk is fascinating. I could have talked with him for hours. But alas, all good things must come to an end. I'm really looking forward to Dr. Parsley's upcoming visit and lecture at IHMC.
Me too. It should be a really fun visit, and I'm looking forward to it.
This episode marks our 8th week on iTunes, and it seems like a really good time to thank the STEM Talk audience for a successful launch.
STEM Talk was immediately featured in iTunes' new and noteworthy category, and was actually in the top position at one point. It has pretty consistently been number one in the science and medicine category and number one in natural sciences, all within new and notable.
Woohoo! That's awesome. We are really glad that folks are enjoying STEM Talk, and thank you again for the 5-star reviews, which have really helped elevate our visibility. I invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage, where one can find the show notes for this episode and learn more about Dr. Parsley, stemtalk.us. This is Don Carnegie signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until next time on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others, so please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.